You're listening to the UFO Talker Podcast. Come with us as we explore UFOs from the past and the present. With insightful discussions, interviews, and reviews, we will add our voice to the mysteries that have been seen in our skies and oceans for all of human history. Now, here's our host, Michael Ryan.
Welcome, everybody, to the podcast. This is Season 2, Episode 34 from Studio 7H here in Ontario, Canada.
And this is Christine Scott coming to you from Studio 9H in the beautiful Warehouse District in Regina, Saskatchewan.
And Christine, it's we don't want to use the S word, but I think in Saskatchewan there's, maybe not where you are exactly, but there's a lot of snow.
Yep, poor LaRange, the LaRange area up north, 40 centimeters.
I know, I know.
Here it's just high winds, blowing snow last night. I wasn't sure what this morning was going to be like, so I didn't make any plans until I had to go for work. Yep.
Isn't this supposed to be spring?
This is Saskatchewan. Yes. I mean, you know, everywhere else, sure. Yeah. You know, all my Ontario friends are going, what?
Yes. Snow? That's so yesterday.
Yeah. Well, when I was auditioning yesterday, I forgot to mention, there was a lady from Los Angeles auditioning, and she was completely stunned by the weather. And she said, is it like this all the time?
So one thing we should tell our listeners, I don't know if we brought this up before, but Christine is actually an actress as well. So, yes, she was doing an audition, which you may be able to see this later on some fancy schmancy network. We'll have to see.
Yeah, it was a very interesting thing because I hadn't done this before. Like, Mike and I are both writers, and when you write, you usually write a pitch. You write a pitch or present a pitch. But I auditioned for something called a proof of concept, which means the filmmaker behind this, all the people behind it, instead of a treatment where you submit it and say, hey, this is my idea, you shoot a trailer for your concept and then pitch it.
Yes.
which is a first time I've ever done this. So if I get it, I'll let everyone know. But I thought, yeah, that's a really interesting way to do it.
I know.
Yeah.
So kind of in my dream world, this is what I'm picturing. It's going to be a huge Netflix show, and somehow we're going to sneak in a UFO Talker t-shirt. The character.
I probably could.
The character is going to be wearing the UFO Talker bling, I think.
Bling, yeah, some bling. I'll wear the cap and,
yes.
Yeah.
The
water bottle. But again, with this proof of concept, it's a long way to fruition for the filmmaker. But what a good way to do it. I'd never heard of this before.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we'll definitely keep the listeners updated as things progress.
Yeah. And nobody knows how your audition will go, but best wishes to all the people involved. And I will keep everyone posted.
On today's show, we're going to have documentary filmmaker Joe Turri, who is making a documentary on a UFO event from 1973. It was the Grand Tower, Illinois event. And I didn't know much about this, but, Hynek was there investigating this, and Jerome Clark has actually written about it. So he's going to be on to talk about that film, which is very interesting. So, Christine, we have some interesting UFO news tidbits. One of them is a brand new website which just came out. It is from the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. And they have 30,000 members who are physicists, aerospace engineers, electrical engineers, and they have their mission statement there, and it looks like it's impressive. I mean, a lot of things start out with the right intentions but don't really go anywhere, but we'll see what happens with these guys. They have a lot of high-powered people on the website who look like they want to get to the bottom of UAP, mm-hmm. So we kind of wish them luck. We'll be following them for sure. So, Christine, also last week there was another Aero briefing, and that's the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office. And I don't know about you, but I think Representative Tim Burchett, I think he needs to get a new publicist, because now it's just kind of a sad look. Like, he's standing in front of the mic saying, you know, dadgummit, I'm going to these meetings, they're not showing me anything. And I thought, wow, okay, like, it looks like you're being played like a cheap dollar guitar. Like, it just is not a good look anymore. He's saying, I'm frustrated, they don't tell me anything. It's the same story over and over and over again.
The headline is, because this is from a couple of different sources, Representative Tim Burchett on UFOs. Yeah, I think there's a cover-up, full stop. So he is throwing out sound bites.
Yes.
Suggested Wednesday, the U.S. government may be intentionally concealing information on these objects from the American public. I think there's a cover-up. Burchett told Blake News. Oh, it is News Nation, The Hill. There are tens of millions of dollars we spent investigating these things. We've had department tells us they have recovery units. They won't release full reports. Everything's covered up. I accuse. Yeah.
Yeah, he's, I don't know. There comes a point where your representative, you want him to see or be seen getting things done.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like he's being played, and look, like, we can tell you're being played. So
yeah,
you just need to stop that, because I feel bad for him, because you're not getting anywhere. You're just a pawn now. Just a part of their game. So it's, yeah, not a good look. And just for our listeners out there, like, I wish he was succeeding. Like, I'm hopeful that he does well. But, yeah, it just doesn't look like he's getting anywhere. So, you know, you need to try a new tact or something.
Mm-hmm. There was a report in the Ottawa Citizen. The headline, Canada joins secret Pentagon meeting on UFOs. DND can't figure out who attended. The Five Eyes Intelligence Alliance reportedly met at the Pentagon to discuss UFO-related activities.
Yes. I read that article as well. And
yeah,
that that's also embarrassing, because it kind of says things like, they're not really, the Canadian Department of Defense is not really interested, and they don't really invest, which is a line that I think most Canadian agencies have used for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
We're not really interested in all that kind of stuff.
I was saying, the Canadian forces do not have any plans for additional meetings with allies at this point, will not be working with the federal government science advisor on the phenomenon. National Defense confirmed to this newspaper, which is the Ottawa Citizen. Pauline also mentioned the military had introductory meetings with the Sky Canada project, which was created in the fall of 2022 by the federal government to study how UAP reports from the public are managed in Canada and recommended improvements, led by the Office of the Chief Science Officer of Canada. The Chief Science Advisor of Canada. But beyond the introductory meeting, Poulin says neither National Defense nor the Canadian Forces are working with or involved in the Sky Canada project.
I know. So that it's
yeah.
So the Sky Canada project, that had so much potential, but
yeah.
The more and more you read about it, the more and more you think, oh, this is just like a PR moment. Because they actually even said, we're not here to investigate anything. And I thought, okay, so if you're not going to investigate anything, well, what's the purpose of Sky Canada Project? Like,
that article just seemed to be running out all the dead ends.
Yes.
And saying, okay, we did this, but we're not going to do this again. We did this, so okay.
I know it's a lot of people have a lot of information on UFOs now, and just to say that we're going to have a project, but we're not going to investigate. And well, what are you going to do exactly? Yeah. Like, you know, it seems very odd to me.
But on the other hand, there was also an article that just came out. Underwater UFOs display capability that jeopardizes U.S. maritime security, ex-Navy officer says. And this was a March 2024 report. Tim Golladay, retired Rear Admiral in the U.S. Navy, just published a report about the dangers of underwater UAPs.
Yeah, so that, I have always been interested in that. And there's always been stuff about, So they used to call them, so there's so many different names people want to use now. They used to be called USOs.
Yeah.
And yeah, there are lots and lots of cases about that, you know, objects underwater going at speeds that are just crazy, like not possible even now by any stretch of the imagination. It's definitely an interesting area, and that Rear Admiral, he's been talked about this a few times. I think that is really fascinating. I'm going to see if we can try and get him on the podcast, because I think what he has to say is kind of probably one of the more important things that's come out recently.
And he's really serious about this. March 2024 report, quote, "The fact that unidentified objects with unexplainable characteristics are entering U.S. water space and the DOD is not raising a giant red flag is a sign that the government is not sharing all it knows about all domain anomalous phenomena," full stop. And for all you movie lovers, we don't have a lot of details, but apparently Steven Spielberg's next project, he is returning to UFOs. There was a report covered by Fangoria and a couple of other sources. It's a little vague, claiming Spielberg's next project will be his original UFO idea. We don't know if this is going to be along the lines of War of the Worlds or closer to Close Encounters, but he's working on it with screenwriter David Koepp, who co-wrote War of the Worlds, and of course we know from Jurassic Park. But as we were saying, Spielberg doesn't really talk a lot about his movies beforehand.
No, but that I did see that, and that has me really interested because I really, really enjoyed Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yeah, and I loved his War of the Worlds, and I'm a, you know, Wells purist. He's made two successful films on the subject, and he says this is his original idea, so nobody knows.
I know. Well, as soon as we find out anything, we'll keep everybody updated on what, because that is definitely captured my attention.
Mm-hmm.
I also want to mention one UFO festival that's coming up. It's the Exeter UFO Festival, and that takes place Saturday, August 31st through Sunday, September 1st of this year. And it's so far, I don't think they have everything pinned down yet, but as speakers, they have Ralph Blumenthal and also Peter Robbins. So that festival is going to take place in Exeter, New Hampshire, and that's, you know, where the famous John G. Fuller book was written about incident at Exeter. And so they normally have a lot of other things going along with the festival, but they haven't pinned down exactly what that is. So definitely that will be of interest. And those are two good speakers, and I think they are going to have more, actually. So, Christine, this week, our shout-out to where we have listeners, our small town or city, is Bountiful, Utah.
Mm-hmm.
And that has a population of 45,762 people. It's a kind of a bedroom community for Salt Lake City. It's not that far away.
No, it's apparently, I looked that up too, because if you Google businesses in Bountiful, they also list Salt Lake City businesses. So I thought that's pretty close.
Yes.
So it's a 15 to 18 minute drive. When we both joked, when we heard the title, we thought about Trip to Bountiful.
I know. That came right to my mind. But that was a movie, A Trip to Bountiful, but that was actually set in Texas. So it was supposed to be Bountiful, Texas.
Well, this Bountiful is named after a city in the Book of Mormon. In the book Alma 52, verse 9, it's the second settlement in Utah. Most of the settlers and many of the present inhabitants are members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. As of 2019, they estimated 80% of the population was Mormon, which makes sense because it's really close to Salt Lake City. They have a beautiful temple there, but it looks like such a gorgeous area. If you want to go hiking, and
The main street there, because I watched videos on it, it is very picturesque, what you would mm-hmm. think of a nice, clean main street, up tree-lined. You know, it just looks really spectacular. And it's kind of on the base of the Wasatch Range, which is kind of starting to get into mountains and hilly areas. So it's very picturesque, that's for sure. There's a couple of things that caught my attention about Bountiful, Utah, is they don't have any Walmarts or no Targets.
Nope.
And I guess that could be on purpose even. And one thing I thought, this is very interesting, most things are closed on Sundays in Bountiful, Utah. And that is kind of an old-fashioned idea. I am of an age where I can remember, it doesn't seem like that long ago, that's what it was like in Toronto. Can you believe it? A major, major metropolitan city, everything was closed on Sunday. And that was kind of a nod to kind of religious ideas. So, but they still have it there. So that part is interesting. I've got a bakery and a restaurant. Who would have thunk it? So as a bakery, I've got Parsons Bakery, and that is run by Mike Parsons, who's been doing it since 1985, and his father actually did it before him. And it looks very, very good. They have two things. If I'm going to Bountiful, Utah, I'm going to Parsons Bakery, and I'm having their German chocolate cookie.
And yum.
You have to, if you're into this, you have to go to their site and check out this cookie, because it's not just a cookie. I think it's kind of an experience. And also their pecan sticky buns. Yeah, that looks good.
Yeah.
As a restaurant, I'd be going to Anne's Cafe, which is kind of crepe-based. They have sweet and savory crepes. There's a sweet crepe here. It's called their Peaches and Cream. It's a vanilla crepe filled with bourbon roasted peaches.
Oh, yum.
Oh, yeah. That is just amazing. But and it's funny, every time we do this segment, I can't help but seeing in my mind's eye, you know, on their brochure, wonderful place to eat, so says UFO Talker. And I have to tell our listeners, I know this is kind of totally ridiculous that we're having bakeries and restaurants and little towns on our show, but, you know, it's quirky. It's different. There's a lot of people say they like it, so that's what we keep doing it. But that is our little jaunt to Bountiful, Utah. So whether you're from Bountiful, Utah, or wherever you are from the 20 or so countries that listen to UFO Talker around the world, we would love to hear from you. So correspond with us, email us. We would love to hear your thoughts. And we will be right back after this message.
In 1983, British ufologist Jenny Randles came up with the term the Oz effect. The term describes a state or a condition that many UFO witnesses find themselves in. One moment, they will be hearing birds and dogs and the sound of the breeze through the trees, and the next minute, all sound seems to fade away. It's not only sound, but all the buildings, streets, and the sky just don't seem the same. It's as if something is out of place, or the reality around you seems to have come to a halt. People who have witnessed a UFO comment later that they had a camera on a nearby table, but during the encounter never thought to take a picture. People who have encountered aliens and moments later go about their day as if nothing has happened. What is the Oz effect? Another dimension? A place where our understanding of the reality around us seems to disappear? Or is it a moment that we are not meant to remember? Next time the sounds around you fade away and something just doesn't feel right, keep your eyes wide open and hang on tight to the world around you.
It's time once again for a book review from Christine Scott. Christine has written for Prairie Dog Magazine, Cracked, and Home Movies Magazine, and she is the co-owner of Centennial Books in Regina, Saskatchewan. Christine, what book do you have for us today?
Today I'm going to be talking about Confession, Our Hidden Alien Encounters Revealed, by Robert Hastings and Dr. Bob Jacobs, published in 2019. It's 286 pages, plus footnotes and appendices. It looks like an Amazon print on demand. Instead of the two authors writing together, it is divided into two separate parts. Number one is Robert Hastings' disclosures, and number two, the testimony of Bob Jacobs. And let me just say, these are two heavy hitters in the UFO world.
Yes.
Yes. Robert Hastings' book, UFOs and Nukes, is an amazing book about UFOs over nuclear test sites, military installations. It's a landmark book. And I'm just going to read, because if people aren't familiar with Hastings, I'm just going to read his biography. Robert Hastings is the leading civilian investigator of UFO activity at nuclear weapons sites, who has utilized hundreds of declassified U.S. government documents and the testimony of 160-plus U.S. military veterans. Robert Hastings is primarily known for his work on UFOs and nukes, and which makes this book really unusual, because it is a deeply personal account of his abduction experiences. And he really struggled with this. It actually begins, several friends and acquaintances have urged me not to write this book.
I know, and it's, because as you know that we have, I've interviewed him in my blog, and I got to chat with him over several emails to set that up. Mm-hmm. And he mentioned that in those emails again, that it was a big, big decision, because he had done his UFO and Nukes book, like the research for that. Mm-hmm. It took like 30 years or something like that. And he interviewed 160 people. He had built up this reputation, which you've mentioned, and he thought, am I going to throw this all away by telling people I have been visited by aliens?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you really have to admire his courage for writing this, where to not write it, probably a lot of people would have said was a better idea.
Yeah, and that he just states that right out. I have been told not to write this book. He puts it really well. He says, I have had unsought interactions with what I have come to believe are non-human intelligences. And he says, as far as he's aware, his first encounter with something else, as he calls it, occurred in the summer of 1952. He was a two-year-old living with his parents in a farmhouse in upstate New York. He doesn't recall the date, but he said one day he was apparently taken from the dinner table by two gray aliens while the rest of his family was in suspended animation. He thinks he interacted in some manner in a cornfield that surrounded the house before being returned to the table and seated in a chair. He kind of blanked this out and started having flashbacks to the event again in his early teens. And then he had an incident when he was camping in New Mexico in 1988, when he was 38 years old. There was a close proximity sighting, which other people also later recounted, gee, something weird happened with my vehicle. So he thinks there might have been a second abduction during that time. He's had weird things like waking up with blood on his bedding's top sheet below his head. And the weird thing is, with his friendship with Bob Jacobs, there was a time when 24 hours later, Bob Jacobs reported waking up finding blood in the exact same spot on his own top sheet in his home in Missouri.
Yeah, it's very, and like you mentioned, because the way they have written the book is it's almost back and forth. Like there's different segments. And then also with Bob Jacobs, you know, because he's the guy that saw the or made the film where the UFO has incapacitated a nuclear warhead in flight.
Yeah.
And so recently this has been in the news because Lou Elizondo said he has seen that film.
Yeah.
But now the film has disappeared mysteriously. But yeah, so it's very current, the book. And also one thing I can add from emailing Robert Hastings back and forth over a few months, he's kind of like his research. So he's very serious, you know, very dedicated. He's everything you would expect. So he's not, he comes off kind of like as a serious researcher. So I can imagine that he did take a lot of time to think about this. Now, one thing he mentioned to me is this book, Confessions, it didn't sell very well. And even nowhere near Nukes, which is wildly, UFOs and Nukes, which is wildly popular. So it could be that people didn't want to hear that side of him. They didn't want to think about that or...
He really rolled the dice writing this, and it's very deeply personal. And it's funny, I thought about when I first read Communion, and you know, Whitley Strieber was essentially, you know, telling the same story about, and almost in the same area, you know, upstate New York abductions.
Yeah,
it's
funny.
I was thinking about that, and I went, Communion was nowhere near as personal as this book. This is very deeply felt.
Yes.
And you can really see his struggle in presenting this and weighing his reputation against it. Which Whitley Strieber, I mean, he was a fiction writer. He didn't have anything to lose. He could put out whatever he wanted. You know, it's very different in this case.
So years ago, I almost had the same kind of feeling that Donald Kehoe had. So... because of Linda Powell's book on Donald Kehoe, you really find out that he drew a line in the sand when it came to talking about aliens. So he was good with everything up to that line, but he just didn't want to talk about aliens. It was almost like a bridge too far. And I used to have that kind of feeling. So in recent years, I've adjusted myself, but... you know, you have to think, well, if these are spacecraft really coming from somewhere else, well, they're piloted by an alien civilization. So if you kind of believe that one thing is possible, you kind of have to believe the other thing is possible. So I've definitely changed my view. And, you know, but it is like what Robert Hastings is saying. Like you think, okay, so he was this very serious researcher, but now he's been abducted. So you really have to change gears in your mind. It's almost jolting a little bit.
Well, he also had, he reports having nasal surgery in 2001, and the surgeon told him of finding what he called a really hard blockage in his right nostril. He had difficulty in removing because it was sucked out with surgical vacuum. I mean, there was no trace of it afterwards, but he says the doctor's full commentary and manner suggested that he was extremely puzzled by the object and had never encountered anything quite like it during his 4-decades-long surgical career. So the issue of an implant is raised with him as well. And his mother actually saw a UFO as well in 1933.
He talks about family, like, it's a generational thing. Like usually if someone's been abducted, it's usually someone in their family has been abducted before them even.
Yeah. There's a whole list of possible abduction timelines for him. Hotel room in Pittsburgh. He had a missing time episode traveling to Mule Creek. And he claims in the book at the time of writing, and I have to say at the time of writing because of the date of the book, at that time, 8 independent UFO sightings, as well as these experiences.
So he hasn't had, so from my interview, which was just a few months ago, he's never had another abduction since the book.
That's what I wondered about, yeah, that I thought you could clarify.
Because that was one of my first thoughts, was I thought, so, you know, once you're finished with the book, that kind of ends, like, what has happened since? But yeah, he's never had an abduction since then, which is interesting.
Well, and going on to Bob Jacobs, is essentially backup for him here.
Yes.
Talking about my friend Robert, you know, the second part of the book. And they're the other thing is they're both in Robert and Bob. I have to say Robert and Bob because they're both Roberts.
Yeah.
They both go through every possibility for what this could be. There's a lot of exhaustive research. They go through every little detail. Could it be this? Could it be that? Here's the current theory. Was it this? Was it that? So these guys are both weighing in on it. And essentially, Bob is supporting Robert. You know, this is my friend. This is what I've experienced with him. And it's a very, actually, I kind of really like the way they wrote it, you know, point counterpoint versus, you know, let's blend our styles and see what we get. Because they're both such distinctive voices in the UFO world. It really works well.
Yes. So, Christine, one thing I'm always interested in when you do your book reviews is how readable was the book? Like, was as a book, does it work?
It's very readable. It's also very conversational. And I would have to give, you really get a sense how hard this was for Robert to write and that he's shored up by Bob Jacobs. I would give it 5 out of 5 discs because he really put his reputation on the line with this book.
Yeah.
And he deserves, you know, he deserves a readership and for people to give it a look because it does not take away from his other work at all. It's a very sincere account of what he believes happened to him from the point of a very dedicated researcher. And he has tried to overturn, could it be this? Could it be that? What are the possibilities here? And exhausted them. And I think it's really worth a read to the person that Robert Hastings is.
I know. I agree with what you've rated it. I've read the book also. And
yeah.
It's very good, and I would say to people who have read UFOs and Nukes, you really do have to change gears to read this book because it's going to take you on a different road than the UFO and Nukes book. But definitely, you know, he's such a monumental figure in ufology. I think you definitely owe it to yourself to read it to understand the full person.
Yeah, don't discount it if you're a hard science UFO person and you go, oh, abductions, that's not my cup of tea. This is Robert Hastings. He's got something to say.
Well, thank you, Christine. And Christine will be back in the coming weeks with another book review. My next guest is Joe Turi. Joe is a writer, director, producer, and has been an independent filmmaker for the last several years. His documentaries include Paranormal Prairie and Creature from Big Muddy. Joe is here today to talk about his next documentary, Grand Tower UFOs and Other High Strangeness. Joe, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Michael. I appreciate you, the invite, and look forward to talking about it with you tonight.
I know, I'm kind of, you know, I saw this and I got really excited about it because I really enjoy, you know, documentaries on UFOs. And one thing I noticed, if you could talk a little bit about it, you also for this documentary, which is not totally finished yet, you started that off with a Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah, so for my previous documentaries, like Creature from Big Muddy was my third one. This is my fifth. For Creature, I did a Kickstarter It went over really well. It's been my most popular documentary to date. I think it's also a good way for people who are interested in this stuff to discover your work or to like feel like they're a part of your work, which is very, I very much appreciate it on my end for sure.
And then I noticed, I think within the first 40 hours, you doubled what your goal was. So it's been doing very well.
Yeah. So there's some very generous people out there and, again, very appreciative of their efforts and their funding to help bring this to life, you know?
I guess the thing I want to know now is, can you give us a little bit of background on the actual Grand Tower UFO sighting? Like, what exactly happened?
Yeah, absolutely. So I discovered this through other researchers. Like, I work with a lot of book authors in my documentaries the last few years. And through them, a friend of mine, Kevin Lee Nelson, who appears in the documentary as well, he mentioned some happenings in Grand Tower. And then talked to another guy, Michael Huntington, who's actually the other researcher for this. And he's going to narrate the documentary. He talked about, well, did you know there was a major UFO sighting in Grand Tower? And you got to realize Grand Tower, like right now, probably population, I don't know, 600-700 people. So what happened? So this is a small river community. It's on the border of Illinois and Missouri along the Mississippi River. Back in 1973, it was a little bit larger community, but not by much. You know, I'm talking like 1,000 people. Well, there was a power plant along the river there. Basically, what happened one night was a gentleman who worked at the power plant, but he wasn't working at the time. He lived in the town. He was alerted to a weird light anomaly that was zipping around the community. You know, it's nestled in southern Illinois. There's some cliff areas there and wooded areas and things like that, and as well as like farm fields. Well, they saw this light zipping around in a very unusual manner, and then it kind of went over in the direction of the power plant. And although he couldn't see, he didn't have a direct line to the power plant, he knew where it was because he worked there. So he called over there, got a hold of another worker, Oscar Wills, and said, hey, look outside, see if, you know, do you see anything out there? So Oscar goes outside. According to his testimony, he said he saw this object. I think he said it was about several hundred feet in the air and about 1,000 feet or so away at the time. And then he said he observed it for quite a while. Just to back up a little bit, before it went over to the power plant, the Hughes family, which is Willis Hughes Sr., is the guy that called the power plant. But he was alerted to it, and he was watching it for maybe over 30 minutes. So then it went over to the power plant, and Oscar said he was observing something for probably the same amount of time. So it was over there for at least an hour. And so Oscar, you know, he called his supervisor, and they ended up calling the main office, which ironically to me is here in Springfield, where I live. I live outside of Springfield, Illinois, and which is about 2.5 hours away from, maybe 3 hours away from Grand Tower. So here in 1973, they're calling their main office where I live and saying and reporting it, you know. And then he said he went out and observed it some more, and basically it was a ring-shaped craft. He said it was basically had a, like a red glow to it, but it also had the typical UFO that you think about where it has the lights on the outside. He said it had like white and red lights, and that kind of blinked to make it, it look like the lights were going in a circular motion, maybe. All of these witnesses said it never made a sound. It ended up coming over the power plant and going to the back section, which is like a transformer area, and was there for a while. And then it took off in a very unusually high speed in a manner in 1973 that craft at that time weren't capable of. I don't even know if that's something like that can happen today. Took over into the Missouri side, and then a couple minutes later, four what they believe are fighter jets chased it, you know, in the direction where it went. Now, in Illinois, there's a base called Scott's Air Force Base. It no longer has fighters there or anything, but at the time, it wasn't unusual for them to be there. And you also have to remember at this time in 1973, there was a huge flap going on in Piedmont, Missouri, which isn't that far away. It's within, I believe, maybe an hour drive or so. So not that far, you know, around 60 miles or so. At that time, there was, in 73, there was reports of, I believe there was, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard about 500 reported UFOs that year. So there was speculation that this could have been a craft from that area exploring a little bit farther into Illinois where there was a power plant.
There was some before the, I had done, you know, I've done research on this for the interview, and a couple of things that really stood out for me was that, like you mentioned, this was almost like a large flap or wave, UFO wave, because so many UFOs were seen by the people in Piedmont. It's unbelievable. Like you're saying, it's not that far to Grand Tower. There was one thing, I read a newspaper article about, I believe it's Oscar, they had interviewed Oscar, and this was at the time, and he was saying he, when it was hovering over him at one point, he actually walked towards it, and this right. was pretty large, and then he got fearful, and I thought, wow, that would take right. some courage to walk towards the object when it was not that high in the air.
I mean, if you think about it, like, what would you do in this situation? Like, if you didn't know what you were looking at, maybe would you go towards? I mean, I don't know what I would do. If
I know. It's
of, you know, what it could actually be, then maybe he was just curious. I'm sure he was. Yeah, that would kind of freak me out.
Yes. Did you? And when I read that too about the jets that came later, were you able to find anything out about that, like follow up with the Air Force or anything?
No. So I was told by one of my witnesses that, you know, they interviewed, his father was Willis Hughes. So I interviewed Willis Hughes Jr. His father was told, basically, that didn't happen. They denied it. So there's wow. official documentation of it. I know that sounds cliche, but I mean, why would the military talk about it? I guess, you know.
And I believe, if I'm getting this right, I don't know if I have it exactly right, but was it? I know J. Allen Hynek, he went to Piedmont, but I think we had a conversation pre-interview before this one, and I think you mentioned that one of the witnesses mentioned his father was interviewed by Hynek.
By a couple people, actually. So Jerome Clark was also involved with it. Jerome Clark wrote an article for Fate magazine, which is still available online today, the magazine. Michael Huntington, my research partner, and he actually has a copy of that of a 1974 Fate magazine, and has an interview by Jerome Clark with Willis Hughes and Oscar Wills. talking about the incident. So there's some details in there that we'll talk about in the documentary. And then, Willis Jr. told me that Dr. Hynek interviewed his dad. I mean, this happened in 73, so he did not know the exact timeline, but he does remember Hynek basically calling his dad up and interviewing him over the phone, and he believes it was for a radio program at the time.
Wow. That would be fascinating to find that. That would be an incredible piece of audio tape for sure.
Hopefully, maybe we can get a little bit more into that and maybe find a copy of that. That'd be great. But just the fact that you have these two main researchers at the time interested in the case, that kind of, for me, gives it a little more credibility. I mean, it's not like, I mean, Hynek was involved with Blue Book before he ditched that program and, you know, did his own thing. So just the fact that he took it seriously, and as well as Clark researched it, that tells me something.
Do you know if I have this right also at the power plant? So there was a total of four witnesses, I believe, that saw it at the power plant that were actually there working at the time.
I don't have that number. So I was contacted by other people that told me there was a couple other main witnesses that worked at the power plant. But that was like, I don't know how credible it is, because there was some details that come out where I was told, well, this guy was an engineer, this guy was an operator of this, and they wouldn't have been working together at the same time. So I kind of like backed off of that angle. So I don't actually know how many people were working at the power plant at the time. I would imagine, though, it was actually more than four. And again, the river town's basically a mile away, but you could see the power plant from town. I know there were more witnesses. I couldn't get a hold of everybody. I mean, this happened 50 years ago, so
I imagine that all the original witnesses are probably no longer with us.
Well, actually, two of them are with us.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so, yeah.
And do you have interviews with them in the documentary?
Yeah, so that's Willis Hughes Jr. and his sister, Phyllis. They're direct witnesses, and yeah, they give their testimony in the documentary. It's really fascinating. I tell you what, so I'm just talking to a lot of people. I'm sure you're the same way. You can kind of tell when people are embellishing.
Yes, or yeah,
you know, maybe didn't really see the stuff they're trying to tell you they saw. These are the most credible people I've ever talked to. If I didn't make this documentary, they would have never really talked about it. You know, they talk about it amongst themselves, but, you know, they're not out for fame. They don't really care about that. He's 80 years old. He really doesn't care. So, I mean, he just tells it like it is. And his sister, she was pretty reluctant to even talk about it because, you know, she's a teacher. But it's like, hey, you know, the way things are nowadays, people don't really, I don't think there's a big stigma about it so much anymore, you know. I think people are pretty aware that UFOs are real, no matter, I mean, that doesn't mean they're aliens. I know a lot of people believe that, but UFOs are real. We have plenty of documentation on that. This isn't something that I don't think you should be scared to tell the story. And thankfully they agreed with that. And, you know,
do you have, and the power plant, it still exists today. Like it's still functioning.
It actually just shut down within the last year, although it's there and there's lights on and there's only a couple workers at a time there at the moment. It's not a functioning plant anymore, but it's there. I can't wait till people see it in the movie. I always thought the first time I saw it, it looks like like if somebody in the 1950s did a comic book about what the future would look like. That's like, it's so odd.
Do you now this? I wondered about this as soon as I heard about it. Has there ever been UFOs seen more recently or since then in Grand Tower?
Absolutely. So not only in Grand Tower, but in the area in general. So part of the main premise of the movie, not only is the UFO story, but is this an area of high strangeness? So was it just a one-off, or is, you know, my researchers told me this was possibly a window area. So that's kind of like the premise of the documentary, is an investigative look into that. Not only was the UFO seen at the power plant on that date, but I've got eyewitness testimony of craft seen before that time and even into modern times. And rumor has it I actually have some video footage and some photographic evidence of that. Yeah.
So all of that information, that will also be in the documentary as well.
Correct, yeah.
And isn't there, I forget where I was reading this, but isn't that area also, for indigenous people, that is kind of an area of, like you're saying, of high strangeness, like it was a sacred.
Yeah, that's, and Kevin Lee Nelson, that's, you know, one of the first things he brought up to me in his, my introduction to the place. So Grand Tower is actually named, what people believe is named after this formation that comes out of the Mississippi River. It's just a column of rock. They call it Tower Rock. It's a very large formation. I mean, like hundreds of people could climb on it, but it's just a kind of looks like a mesa coming out of the middle of the river. And then what's interesting to me is I just found out recently there was actually multiple rock formations there. And the Army demolished them for ease of river traffic, you know, because a lot of barges go through the area. So they had to kind of clear the area out. So when I've seen pictures of it, and probably have that in the documentary as well. But if you can imagine the Native Americans at the time, who there was mound builders along the river. We have an area called Cahokia Mounds. It's not too far north of Grand Tower. So it was the largest Native American community. I don't know from how, what distance, but it was like they said there was, I want to say, over 10,000 natives at one time there. Anyway, so all along the river area there, there's Native American old villages, obviously nothing substantial, but there's like rock formations, different forts that they built. There's in Grand Tower alone, there are, from one of my researchers, 13 burial mounds, Native American burial mounds. So there's some stories of high strangeness with that. So the Native Americans considered this, they look for geographical features that they considered sacred. I feel like, you know, part of the documentary is looking into that, trying to see like why were they drawn to this area? And I mean, I have all kinds of theories on that myself, nothing I can prove, you know, but I feel like, as they were hunters and gatherers as well, obviously. So maybe when they come across an area where they felt different or made them feel different, for whatever reason, they consider that a sacred area. So that area happens to be along a major fault line in the Midwest. At one time, there was a earthquake that reversed the flow of the Mississippi River. And that's part of this fault line. So it makes me wonder if there's some natural features in the earth that kind of that people can feel, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like,
yeah,
maybe messes with their heads or maybe causes vision or anything like that. But yeah, there's a lot of Native American history there. There's petroglyphs all over the place. It's a truly amazing area for sure.
And also in my research, I was surprised that it's an area also where a lot of odd sounds are. You know, there's these sounds that people hear around the world where they don't know where it's coming from and they can never track it down. And there's also some electromagnetic.
Electromagnetic anomalies, which turn out to be true. Again, there's theories on what causes that stuff. Is it a window area? So could be. Another interesting fact is Grand Tower. I don't know how much I believe in the 37th parallel, but it is worth a note that it does lie along the 37th parallel with Piedmont and another town called Cape Girardeau. And I think that we talked a little bit about that before, but there was a major UFO crash in Cape Girardeau. And I think it was in 41.
I know. Yeah. That's,
which is kind of covered up too. Like, it seems like the people in the area know about it. And maybe people that are really into, ufology or, know about it, but it's not as popular as other areas, you know?
Yes.
But it was a major event at the time.
So, Joe, that is fascinating. I am really excited to see this documentary, especially the witness interviews. But before we wrap this up, I just want to mention that I'm going to put links to several of Joe's websites and also his Kickstarter campaign for this documentary in my show notes. And I just want to thank Joe for being on the show today. Wow, it's been really interesting. I'm really looking forward to the documentary.
I really appreciate that, Michael. I'm looking forward to sharing it with everyone. I hope everybody gets as much of a kick out of it as I do. I think people will be surprised about, you know, different discoveries that we've done. And I think everybody will really appreciate the sincerity of the witnesses and just the event in general. And again, I really appreciate you asking me to come on and share my story with you.
Here are the Canadian Civil Aviation Anomalies for the week of April 15th through April 19th, 2024. On April 15th, a Government of Canada, Department of National Defence, Augusta Westland EH-101, flying from St. John's, Newfoundland to Goose Bay, Newfoundland, reported an unidentified aircraft moving at a high speed north of Gander, Newfoundland. Lights were visible intermittently for approximately an hour. No traffic in that area. Also on April 15th, from an aviation incident report, Anchorage Air Route Traffic Control Center reported an unknown Government of Canada Department of National Defence aircraft was illuminated by a green laser while northbound at 4,000 feet, 5 nautical miles east-northeast of Fort Greely, Allen Army Airfield, Alaska. Alaska State Police were notified. On April 16th, a Sunwing Airlines Boeing 737-81D flying from Santa Clara, Cuba to Montreal Pierre Elliott Trudeau International Airport, Quebec, reported strong LED lights off their right-hand side while landing, blurring the pilot's vision. The aircraft landed safely. There was no impact on operations, and all flights proceeded to their destinations without further incident.
Well, that's our podcast for this week. Please share, follow, and subscribe and do all those good things to help spread the word about UFO Talker. And until next time, this is Michael Ryan. Keep watching the skies.
You have been listening to the UFO Talker. If you have any questions or comments on this episode, You can email us at ufotalker@bell.net or visit our website at ufotalker.ca. You can support UFO Talker by using the Buy Me a Coffee app with links on our website and in the show notes. We appreciate every listener. Thank you for your support. This has been a Michael Ryan production.
30. That's a wrap.